Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Every city government is either in a situation where they are facing fiscal difficulties, they're looking forward to the fact that that's coming down the road for them. They are looking to see, is this a model where we can solve our problems on the backs of people who were promised decent pensions when they worked for their entire working life? So that is what everybody is looking to see. How is this going to go down in Detroit? And yes, there will be reactionary city governments around the United States looking to see, can we do this too? And if we let them do this, it will be an even greater tragedy.
That's the voice of longtime activist, author, and academic Robin Hanel. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Hanel about the unfolding tragedy in Detroit and how Detroit's bankruptcy could be used as a blueprint for other struggling U.S. and Canadian cities. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to have Dr. Robin Hanel. He is an economist. His latest book, Participatory Economics. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you this morning.
When we think about the role of the White House, some people would tell you, well, there's very little he can do because there's many other layers of the bureaucratic system that prevent him from doing so. But I look at previous examples. President Bush was very effective about imposing a war, you know, economy, and he was very effective about moving the country in this preemptive war path. This president ran on a platform of bringing equity and a redistribution of wealth, and doesn't seem to be able to do any of those things. Now, I want to talk specifically about the programs that he could have targeted and that would have made a difference, not just in Detroit, but eventually I would like to focus on Detroit as well, because it is the state that has now filed for bankruptcy. So can we talk a little bit about the kinds of programs that could have been targeted to redistribute some of the wealth that is now concentrated on the 1% in America?
Obama was elected. We were entering the greatest economic crisis that, you know, the advanced economies have seen in four generations. And there was tremendous popular concern and anger over, you know, those who had brought us to this situation. The election was clearly a rejection of the 8 years of Bush Republican rule, their aggressive imperialistic policies abroad, and also the use of the Bush administration of the 9/11 attacks in the United States as a way to erode civil liberties here in the United States. There was a tremendous opportunity for, you know, somebody who had campaigned saying, we need new ideas and new politicians. That's why he told us we shouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton in the primaries, because, yes, she was a Democrat, but she was the old brand of Democrat, and we needed somebody new. Now, the truth of the matter is that for the entire time he's been in office, all we've heard is sort of silver-tongued words about liberal values, and yet his actual actions have, you know, continued all of the neoliberal regressive policies that were being followed under the Bush administration. In terms of economic policy, he did not pursue aggressive financial reform legislation. He stood on the sidelines and watched the opportunity to respond to the greatest financial crisis since 1929. In 29, when Wall Street brought the economy crashing around everybody's heads, then we had a president and who led a Congress to serious financial reform. That was part of the New Deal. Obama, unlike FDR, did not use the opportunity when 90% step in and stop the Wall Street banks from doing the kinds of things they're doing. And he did not seize that opportunity at all. In simple terms, when you have a recession, and a recession that's the largest recession, you know, in 80 years, then you need to use aggressive fiscal stimulus policy. And Obama was basically very weak on that. He did not come out for a strong fiscal stimulus. He squandered the opportunity to do that when the iron was hot in his first year. And then he pivoted and went into the right-wing talking points about deficit and deficit reduction, which made it virtually impossible, you know, to get any sort of fiscal stimulus moving in Washington, which is why it is that the recession had lingered on for 5 years and still showed no end in sight. We now have 10% unemployment as the new normal, and he has presided over that. Weakness is that he's sort of milquetoast, mild-mannered. He doesn't like to fight. Well, he doesn't like to fight the powers that be. He doesn't like to fight the fossil fuel industry. He doesn't like to fight the financial, the Wall Street. He seems to be very aggressive at fighting against whistleblowers and going after people like Snowden and going after people like Manning, who are pointing out and making apparent to the American public how much of the constitutional rights of liberty have been torn up under his administration. So I think that the image of Obama as he's just too nice, well, he's too nice to the powers that be, but he doesn't have any trouble getting nasty. When people who supported him from a progressive side say, my gosh, you're not doing what we elected you to do, he gets plenty nasty. You know, when the unions and workers and the environmental movement point out, and the movement is trying to protect our civil liberties, when they point out what an abysmal job he's doing, he gets plenty nasty to them.
It's important to know that while we are hearing Barack Obama speak about the need to, to close the gap between that 1%, they got a big hike in wealth, you know, over 40% raise since 2009. And, you know, the majority of the people that are now struggling to make ends meet, he talks about making this a first priority, but there is simple things he could do. The issue of Social Security, you know, a healthcare program that covers all people. None of this had been taken up by him. Now, if you speak to Democrats who think he's the lesser of two evils, they tell you we had no choice but to elect Barack Obama. What were our choices, and what are our choices now?
True that in the United States, progressives are in a real bind when it comes to electoral politics. I don't believe there's a single country in the world where the electoral game is more fixed and stacked against the ability of progressives to make electoral gains and elect politicians, even when the majority supports certain positions. It's harder in the United States to elect politicians who will do what the majority would like to have done. I believe certainly in Canada, certainly in Europe, and certainly in Latin America. So we have an electoral bind here, and we are frequently faced with the dilemma that do you vote for the lesser of the evils, even when that person, you know, is predictably, you know, not going to do the things that you would like to see done. And Obama is a perfect example of that. Would it have been better to have, you know, McCain elected rather than Obama? No. It would have probably been worse. But that doesn't change the reality that the Obama administration, now going on, you know, 6-7 years, has been a disaster. It's been in terms of economic policy, it's been a disaster. In terms of environmental policy, it's been a disaster. In terms of civil liberties, it's been a disaster. In terms of foreign policy, it's been a disaster. It doesn't change the fact that the lesser of the evils is increasingly evil and increasingly unacceptable. And in the meantime, our two great crises, you know, continue to escalate. And I would add now the civil liberties. everybody. In terms of the economy, are we going to have a new normal? He is now out campaigning with rhetoric about how wrong it is for the top 1% to be continuing to, you know, appropriate all of the efficiency gains that come in the economy. And everybody else is stagnant or is continuing to fall farther and farther behind. He can give speech after speech, silver tongue speech about how awful this is and how it is that it's the Republicans in the House of Representatives that are preventing anything from being done about it. But the truth of the matter is he's doing nothing about it. And the truth of the matter is that he has squandered opportunities to do things about it. He has rejected the advice of people who have told him how to do effective things about it.
Obama was reelected in 2012, and the first week in office, he came up with the $1.6 trillion tax hike on corporations, and there was a lot of, notions about a fiscal cliff and the expiring of tax cuts. This idea that we were approaching a fiscal cliff, and that, you know, somehow everyone needed to be taxed or punished equally to pay for that debt has been very popular among conservative governments. But what has been the outcome? And here I think we need to focus directly on what has happened in Detroit.
In Europe, we have fiscal austerity, and that is why the European economy is in the worst shape of any economy in the world. That's why they are back in recession. That's why there is no end in sight. In the United States, what we have had is a different version of fiscal austerity that's taken the form of the sequestration. The sequestration is fiscal austerity. The fact that, and there are programs, there are spending programs all over the United States where people are being laid off, where services are being cut. It's not only inhumane, it's not only unnecessary, it's also counterproductive from a purely economic perspective. All it does is prolong the recession and prolong the period of unacceptable joblessness. Detroit is the extreme case, and let's talk about Detroit. From 1920 to roughly 1970, Detroit was the prototypical example of a certain kind of new modern industrial economy. It was built around automobile industry. So here was a modern manufacturing industry that was at the center of sort of the 20th century industrialization process. It also was an example of a situation where you have not only a very strong industry, the automobile industry in the city, it was the best example of where workers' movements built unions that managed to capture some of that productivity and some of the benefits of that spurt in production, industrial production for ordinary people. At first, it was captured for white workers. And then in the 60s, it became an example of unions that were increasingly integrated and the revolutionary black workers' movement. And so increasingly, it wasn't just white workers who achieved the kind of middle-class living standard in Detroit. It was also a city in which black workers did too. But the model was old economy. The model was no public transportation. Build huge, wide streets so that people can live very far away from where they work and drive to work quickly on throughways. The big story in Detroit is the old economy is dead. It is not going to be revived. And Detroit is sort of a symbol of the death of a city that was built on the automobilization of the industry and the infrastructure, et cetera. Now, Detroit has been in recession. The recession that hit the rest of the country, you know, in 2008. The truth of the matter is Detroit was already living, you know, in recession because of the dying of the automobile industry 10, 20 years earlier. So the writing was already on the wall in Detroit. Something new has to be done. And basically nothing new was done. The bailout of GM, you know, did nothing to revitalize Detroit. And Detroit is now the example of the industrial city in decline, a largely African-American city. It's a symbol of everything that's wrong. At the political level, we have a white Republican governor Detroit that have nothing to do with what the overseer administration is doing. And it is a kind of revitalization of Detroit on a totally different model. The idea that Detroit cannot live the old way, and to survive, it's going to have to pull itself up by the bootstraps and develop a new economy along new lines. That is something that is alive and well in Detroit. There's an excellent PBS show that people should look at, interviewing a remarkable woman named Grace Lee Boggs. This is a PBS show. You can go ahead and get it on the internet. Here's a 98-year-old woman who's very well known to leftists in the United States. She's been active on the far left for her entire life. She's extremely well known in broader circles in Detroit because she has always been an activist in Detroit for the past 60 years. And her interview is an interview of hope, because she is pointing out that in all of these abandoned lots and fields that are stretching for acres and acres and acres, there are people who are planting gardens, there are people who are starting up new kinds of economy activities. Basically, when you've been abandoned by the old economy and by the government, that's the state government in Michigan, the city government in Michigan, and the national government in Washington, you have no choice but to try and save yourself. And there are some incredibly creative and inspiring stories that are coming out of Detroit along those lines.
I agree with you that we need to be open to the possibilities the crisis births sometimes, you know, this idea that we can renew our sense of community, our sense of reciprocity, and be able to work with each other, as, you know, was the case when the Argentinian economy collapsed. You know, we've seen that happen over and over in many war-torn countries where people are displaced and they have to literally, you know, come together to survive. But I think it's important to recognize that this bankruptcy marks a new low in the kind of theft that is taking place from the rich is taken from the poor. This usurpation of wealth that is from the bottom up. If the government is allowed to declare bankruptcy, to forego paying the pensions of workers who have dedicated their entire lives.
You're absolutely right about that. At the macro level, at the big political level, what's happening is that the governor has appointed somebody who has gone ahead and sort of orchestrated a bankruptcy. And the question is, who's going to pay the piper? And what they are attempting to do, and it looks like they're being successful, is to say, look, we have all these pensions. These are older people who are retired. They are on pensions. We're going to cut services and pensions. And we are not going to force the banks and the creditors to take a major haircut. We are going to save the banks. We're going to save the wealthy that are, you know, are the owners of the bonds. First of all, it's totally unfair. Second of all, it's completely unnecessary. There's no reason that that you can't have the creditors take a haircut. And it's also very counterproductive in the sense that how can you build a new economy? Well, part of what's happening is, you know, younger people who can't find jobs are moving back in with their parents. Those parents are the ones that are on the pension. Those pensions are now, you know, being stretched to support more people than before, and you're going to go ahead and cut them. Well, part of what you need to build a new economy is to provide livelihoods for the people that are doing that in new and better ways. And essentially what they're doing is making it more difficult by cutting those livelihoods. It's also every city in the U.S., every city government is either in a situation where they are facing fiscal difficulties, they're looking forward to the fact that that's coming down the road for them. They are looking to see, is this a model where we can solve our problems on the backs of people who were promised decent pensions when they worked for their entire working lives? So that is what everybody is looking to see. How is this going to go down in Detroit? And yes, there will be reactionary city government around the United States looking to see, can we do this too? And if we let them do this, it will be an even greater tragedy.
I think this is a problem not just for Detroit, but for all of us in Canada, in the U.S. I mean, we're the neighbors, and whatever happens in the U.S. usually tends to be copied by Canadians. What prevents the state of Detroit from simply saying, no, we won't be paying these debts, and we'll be reinvesting, creating a local bank, and revitalizing our economy?
There is absolutely no reason that cannot be done, and it is clearly what should be done. And the fact that in the public discourse and the major media and amongst the major politicians, that option is not even discussed is just absolutely mind-boggling. There is no reason that can't be done.
I mean, if Obama can forgive the banks and give $13 trillion away to bail them out, why can we, you know, pay the $18 billion to Detroit
or whatever? Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about alternatives, because I think that not only are the alternatives not being shared, but there is a deliberate attempt to silence those who, to provide alternatives. You wrote a book, Of the People, By the People. Let's talk a little bit about a participatory alternative in Detroit.
There's a phrase out there now that is increasingly something that people have heard about. The person who I think has popularized this phrase more than anybody else is named Gaurav Paribas, and he calls it the new economy. And what he means by the new economy is, well, it has to be environmentally sustainable. It can't be fossil fuel-based. So it's new in the sense that it's environmentally new. What's new about the new economy is it's not large corporations, privately owned, you know, managed for profit only, you know, operating all around the world. It's ownership patterns are different. Now that can be workers owned cooperatives. That can be sort of consumer cooperatives. It can be locally supported agriculture. Portland is an example of a city where I live that has more of this. We have more NGOs per capita than any other city in the United States. I ate yesterday at a local neighborhood pub. It's just open. And its business model is that it's a nonprofit, and when you go in there, you order your food, good local beer, good local agricultural products that are being used to make good food, and you simply, when you pay your bill, you designate what progressive organization you want the profits that would have gone if that was a profitable, you know, restaurant. You simply designate which of these projects, these progressive projects, you know, would you like the profits from your meal to go to? This is the new economy. It's local. It's jobs that don't go overseas. It's sustainable. It's being built in Detroit in a disastrous situation. It's being built in Portland because there's a tradition here where there's more of that in any case, but we increasingly need it. And that's the new economy. And that's the way forward. It's different ownerships. It's different ways of managing wealth. It's a rejection of the economics of competition and greed and the large multinational corporations and the sway of market forces. It says, that's not working. That doesn't work. We are building something that's very, very different. Now, my book is very visionary. It says, that's the right path. If we think clearly about what kind of an economy would accomplish these goals best, what does it really look like and how might it work in the distant future? And I'm happy to say that people like Gaurav Paribas, who are fighting in the here and now, and that I do too, they also are saying, look, people need to be thinking not only about the here and now, this little project, that little project, but as we move forward, is there a coherent model that becomes the system, the new system that helps us do these things we want to do. And that's what my book is about. It's about helping people think systematically. Is there a way that you can make the new economy, you know, a new economic system whereby we do everything that way?
Thank you so much for being with us this morning. How can people access your book?
Support your local bookstores. It's distributed by AK Press. If you buy through AK Press, go to their website. Then that helps them. If you have to buy from Amazon, you're helping Amazon.
In closing, I have one last question for you. According to the Canadian publication Global Research, there are 47.8 million of Americans living below the poverty line. Now, when we do research, we know that these numbers tend to be a lot higher often, but using that number, what inspires you that we can create change? It seems, you know, not only transform our economy, but also create a more equitable society.
Social change is a complicated thing, and it's not a precise science. And the main lesson is you just keep at it, you keep at it, you keep at it. That more often than not, what we discover is that people who kept at it during times when it looked like they were making no progress at all were actually the necessary component that at some point later allowed, you know, tremendous amounts of progress that suddenly burst upon the scene in ways that nobody would have predicted. That, I think, is the lesson. All sorts of things contribute to that. The fact that the powers that be and the ruling elites are doing such a miserable job of addressing climate change and economic hard times, and everything they're doing is just making matters worse. It drives more people to look for alternatives and to fight for alternatives. And the more better ideas we have and the better the success of those ideas, the more that people will recognize we can do things better. It's just to keep at it, keep at it. There is no other alternative, and that there never has been.
Thank you again for being with us today.
It was great being on with you, Sylvia.
Thank you again. Take care.
Okay.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.